Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
I'm Michelle Martin. Welcome to the show where we talk about what investors are talking about on the day itself. So the ASX 200 was up about 1.25% when the trade stoppage came into effect this morning. So we thought we'd check in with our friend down under, Jack Hoosey, founder and director of strategy at the VFS Group. So Jack, in the infamous words of Marvin Gaye, what's going on?
Oh, we don't know what's going on here. It's an interesting morning. So just so your viewers know, we have what we call a staggered start here on the ASX. So, you know, A to B companies open up at 10:01 and it staggers on. So we saw the market open and then we thought, oh, where is Westfield or where are the W companies? They haven't come on yet. And then we saw a tweet from the Australian Stock Exchange saying that they were having issues and there's no trading. So it's on days like this that I wish I was more heavily invested in Australian markets rather than global markets, because I probably could have had the day off, unfortunately. But we're not. So we're still down. It is 1:08 p.m. and we have no news from our exchange at this point in time. But yeah, it's been an interesting day. I can remember this happening a few years ago.
Yeah.
But not for so long. Yeah, but it's interesting to see what went wrong and why and how they're going to fix it. But I will say this to you, Michelle. It doesn't matter, because Australians are not buying stocks anyway. We're just buying property at the moment. I don't know if you know, but we are going through one of the biggest property booms I've ever seen in, you know, 10 years of being a property investor. It is crazy down here. Stocks are going, property, I should say, is going like hotcakes.
Wow. Wow. And that's your local domestic market supporting the property boom, not so much foreigners?
No, it's local. I mean, I think we talked about this last month. Money is just cheap, right? And there's, you know, you can borrow now a home loan rate. You can get here at 2%, which is, you know, unheard of 5 or 6 years ago, or 10 or 15 years ago. And what you are seeing is a lot of these coastal towns in Australia, they are, I mean, it's melting up, you know. So we're seeing, you know, double-digit returns on some of these in the last 6 months. Because of this de-urbanisation that we keep talking about, people working from home, realising that they probably don't have to work so close to the city, and our coastal towns are certainly seeing a big move. And it's, I was reading a report, people are buying sight unseen, like not even seeing the property, no cooling down period, because it's just so hot at the moment. It's actually a bit scary to watch, to be honest.
Wow. Melting up, you say. Hey, how's the COVID situation doing? We're receiving news this morning that South Australia is looking at a resurgence of cases. How's the COVID situation where you are?
Look, all in all, I think we're on top of it. You know, we are going to see a little bit of a hot spot, like you just noticed. But we had, you know, a couple of days of zero transmissions around the country, zero community transmissions. The state and the governments have done a fantastic job. Obviously, our borders are still closed. We still have some state borders that are still closed off to each other. But that looks like we're going to get a reopen, you know, maybe in December or early on. But all in all, I'm happy to report that the situation seems to be under control. Of course, you know, we've got to remain vigilant, both as citizens and as governments. But, you know, we're certainly starting to look like what we kind of looked like before, you know, the lockdown. Not exactly the same, but I can see a lot of economic activity. And that's because, you know, the transmissions are quite good. Now, our biggest area was Victoria or Melbourne, as your listeners might know, and they've had some really promising results and they've started to reopen. So fingers crossed, it looks good for a good, nice summer here down under.
All right. Jack Hoosey is founder and director of strategy at VFS Group. Let's go through some of the big headlines that investors have been talking about. What do global investors like you take from Ant Group's failed IPO? I was reading a Wall Street Journal report that said it was Chinese President Xi Jinping who personally decided to pull the plug on Ant Group's initial public offering. I mean, what does this mean for investors looking at China tech, China stock in particular?
Yes. You know, I follow this space really, really closely, so I'm really glad you asked that question. I mean, it was very interesting what happened. You know, the fact that, firstly, the IPO was pulled a day before they were meant to list. You know, that was quite interesting. Let's just look about the background of why they stopped the IPO. We were always looking at Ant as a fintech firm. And just to give your listeners a bit of an idea, when Ant Financial, or Alipay as we know it, or Ant Financial lends money, Ant usually only lends about 2% on their books. So they borrow, the bank gives up the money, right? So they're only lending about 2%. Now, what the Chinese regulators are saying is you've got to have more skin in the game. Mm. Your balance sheet has to be at risk here, and therefore you've got to lend 30% now. So that really cuts the valuation and makes you look at the company very differently. Now, and the reason why the Chinese regulators are doing this is they're worried about bad credit in the system. And that's something to be worried about, because we know that recessions normally happen when you give money to people that shouldn't have it or shouldn't borrow. So that was the key point they said to Ant, and they kind of, you know, told all the other fintech companies in China, including Tencent, you're on watch now. We want to treat you more like a bank. And when you're putting up the money, your valuation doesn't look like a fintech company, you're going to look like more of a bank. And that obviously brings into your multiple into question. So that was the interesting point of it. I don't think it's actually a bad idea. I think China and the regulator has done investors a bit of a favor by doing this before the IPO, rather when the company listed at the enormous valuation it had, and then you suddenly get a cut in the stock price. And I think that they did that for two reasons. One, they wanted to show Ant who was boss, and I'll come back to that. They also wanted to protect Chinese retail investors who had oversubscribed enormously to the IPO. You know, there were stories of Chinese retail investors borrowing money to get into the Ant IPO. So that's, I think, the key reason why they curtailed it right then. And you talked about President Xi Jinping. Yes, it was him. You know, you've got to remember his darling is the star market. It's his market. He didn't want to see something list and then decrease in price because of the regulation. And I also think it was a sign to Jack Ma and the tech billionaires within China to say, who's your daddy? Your daddy is the Chinese government. And, you know, there were a number of plays here, both from a regulatory point of view and a political point of view, that was happening. Now, the question is, what does Ant do going forward? I don't think you're going to see this IPO for another 6 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see a heavily discounted IPO, the fact that they've got to put more money in terms of their lending. So it also sends a warning. We saw Chinese tech stocks really, you know, come off because of it. In terms of China tech, we're not going to let you get away with everything. We're going to regulate you. We're going to bring you in line, and we're going to make sure that growth is consistent with the goals of the Chinese Communist Party. So a lot of layers there to unpack, but, you know, it was like watching a movie. And it was in the midst of the U.S. election. Don't forget that. So world's largest IPO, not 24 hours before it's due to list.
So news this morning is that China's top banking regulator has pledged to lower the risk of such companies becoming too big to fail, saying, you know, companies shouldn't hide behind this notion of innovation if they're going to be breaking rules of fair competition to benefit themselves. So in light of what's happened and in anticipation of the ratcheting up of companies that are innovating, like Ant, what does this mean for Alibaba, you know, is it a buy for Baba? Yes. Because Baba shares have tumbled about 17% since its shelving of Ant Group's IPO.
Yeah, and it might tumble a little bit more. So you've got to remember, you know, Alibaba has a 30% ownership of Ant. So, you know, when you talk about that type of thing, you know, a lot of the move that we saw on Alibaba was in anticipation, particularly in the last couple of months, was in anticipation of the Ant Financial IPO and that adding that valuation to the company. So, you know, I think Alibaba is one to watch. I love the stock. In 2019, I was asked to call my best stock, and I really like Alibaba long-term, but right now might be a question. It brings into play this question that the Americans are doing. Also, we talk about these two types of techs around the world. Is how big can you let tech go? And I think China is trying to rein in this right now through this regulation, through this warning shot to them. And if you've got to look at Chinese tech, you know, there's really two massive players in terms of Alibaba and Tencent. Then you've got a few outliers like Meituan, but they're two really dominant ones. So, you know, domination is good, but it also kind of stifles innovation if they keep just buying everybody out. So it's a very interesting play, and it's a very interesting to watch what happens to Chinese tech going forward. But I think the Chinese government is making moves now before it's too late. And they're certainly in a better position to do that than their U.S. counterparts because of their system of the government. And, you know, this was a win, I think, in a battle, the scuttling of Ant. And I think it's put everybody on notice. And you're right, you know, tech companies shouldn't be under the weight of innovation. You have to play by the rules that we have because those rules, you know, work. And I think that's what the Chinese government's doing. So this is still to play out. It'll be interesting to see how far they go and who they go after next.
That's great. There's so much more to the story than meets the eye, really. So if Alibaba has portrayed itself as a tech company all this while, and therefore the high valuation was tied to that, is it increasingly going, if it is going to be regulated like a bank, is it quite certain that the level of profitability is going to come down for it?
Yeah, I mean, sure, absolutely. You know, when we talk about Alibaba, you know, they have 30% of Ant Financial, but they've still got some other arms. I mean, they're the fastest growing cloud company in the world. You still got their massive e-commerce. They have ownership in many, many other industries. I mean, this is a check mark. You know, you've got to wave it up. But what I can say about Ant is, you know, you can't apply the multiple that you did previous to this move by the Chinese government. So, you know, you start to get in the middle of a tech and a bank. You know, when you look at banks, they're trading at 9 and 10 multiples, right? And tech companies are trading 30 and 40 times. You kind of got to meet somewhere in the middle. So I think this is actually, you know, a bit of a depression on the stock price and also on Tencent. I mean, Tencent came out, you know, they obviously all got WeChat and they're in that system. And they said, we're going to improve our capital controls and we're going to put more money on the table in anticipation of more regulation. So a lot of question marks. What I will say is these are all very fundamental companies. They're very big. They've got their hands in many, many other industries. They will survive and they will grow. They probably just won't grow in terms of the share price that we're used to in the next 6 to 12 months, which could create a really good buy opportunity, I think, for investors.
Okay, great to hear. He's Jack Cousy, our guest this morning, founder and director of strategy at the VFS Group. All right, let's move. How are you feeling after the results of the U.S. elections?
I could use with a few more hours of sleep. I mean, it was riveting, wasn't it?
It really was.
To be honest with you, I'm a little bit sick of it now. You know what I mean? I think I'm over the U.S. election a little bit. I don't know if you're feeling like that, Michelle, but I'm kind of like, now when I hear it, I just drown it out or I play something else. Like, I'm a little bit over it.
I don't know. I feel it still feels like a cliffhanger because, you know, we're waiting on an actual seeding. You know, the latest tweet was he won, but it was a rigged election. So we still, it still feels like the cliffhanger is yet to happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
A Goldman Sachs economist. Go ahead.
No, I think you will see an orderly transition of power. That's what I think will happen.
I hope so.
I think you will. I think in the end, this is still the largest democracy in the world. They will see an orderly transition of power. It'll happen. That's my opinion.
Well, hopefully, separation of powers allows that to happen. A Goldman Sachs economist, though, says the U.S. election will likely result in a divided government, and that could lead to Asian currencies appreciating against the greenback. So what do you think of this theory?
Yeah, I think you're going to see some U.S. weakness. I mean, there's a number of factors that I think you're going to see the dollar weakness. You know, you still have the possibility of a blue wave, and I always said we don't want to talk about the election, but they still could get the Senate. But what you are going to see out of the Biden government, which I think is going to happen, is enormous fiscal spending and enormous spending. Now, when you spend money, you've got to print money, which, you know, devalues your currency anyway. What also happens is the fact that we've got a divided economy and the fact that the U.S. is struggling to keep these COVID cases under control means they may not be the center of where the money flows in terms of investment. So you may see some movement of funds away from U.S. markets into other areas of the globe. And to make sense of that, what happens in currencies is you've got to sell U.S. assets in U.S. dollars, so you've got to sell U.S. dollars, and buy other assets across the globe, you've got to buy those currencies. So that's where you get that, you know, that trade-off between that. And then the question is, okay, if money is going to flow out, or there are other areas of the world where we think there's investments going to be good, where is it going to be? And Asia is certainly that place. Europe is a basket case. I want to put my money in there. I would encourage your investors to do so in certain areas. Asia is where we're starting to see, you know, you have some spikes in the case, but it's innovative. It's the center of the world. And then you've got China, which Asia is in the bosom of, which is, you know, on fire at the moment. And there's a thirst for Chinese assets and a thirst for Asian assets. And Asian flow of funds. So I actually anticipate U.S. weakness over the next 3 to 6 months because of a number of factors. Now, in terms of the U.S. economy, I still think they're going to grow really well. You know, they're going to bounce from this. But they have been a divided country for quite a long time, and they've managed to keep it going. And I think they'll continue. But there's no doubt that the center of where this money is going and investing is now in China. And China is on fire, and there is a thirst for Chinese assets right now, not just Chinese stocks, you know, the Chinese companies, Chinese property in that bosom of China. And that's why I think you're going to continue to see US dollar weakness. And we're seeing the rise of the renminbi or the yuan. And it makes sense, right? Because if funds are flowing into China, you're going to have to sell a currency and buy, you know, Chinese assets with yuan or renminbi. And that's why we've seen that appreciation of the yuan over time. It's gotten stronger and stronger. The interesting point there, a little bit of a sublayer for your listeners, is the Chinese have allowed it to get stronger, right? And normally they don't like it to be as strong because they want their exports to be competitive. Hmm. Now, that's an interesting point of view. Now, there's two views on why they're allowing it to get stronger. One, they want a bigger domestic economy. They want to import more. Having a higher currency means they can, their citizens can import at a lower price. The second view is they can't weaken it because in order to weaken it, they've got to sell US dollars to buy their currency to make it stronger, or so to weaken it, and they don't have enough US dollars on hand to do that or to play the markets like they used to.
Yeah.
And then there's this question of, you know, can the renminbi become, you know, the global currency or the world's leading currency? Mm. Let me put this to bed right now. It's not going to happen in our lifetime, right? And the reason why is because when you look at global trade, China makes up around 10 to 15% of global trade. It's a big portion. Yet, only 1% of transactions around the world, or a little bit over 1%, are made in the renminbi. Okay, so you can't be the world's reserve currency if you dominate world trade. But when we look at the US dollar, gold still trades in it, iron ore still trades in it, oil still trades in it. You know, the world's banking system still works on the US dollar. So I think you're going to see US dollar weakness, but it is still the world's reserve currency, which gives the US a very, very big advantage when, you know, when it goes to becoming, you know, the number one superpower around the globe. But very interesting thing to play in the currency market.
Okay, so optimistic about Asian currencies appreciating, likely led by the renminbi and the yen, right?
Yeah.
All right, terrific.
Well, summarized.
Jack Kuzi is founder and director of strategy at the VFS Group, joining us here on Money and Me. All right, let's talk about the vaccine and the good news. Last week, Pfizer's vaccine, 90% efficacy, that really moved markets. What are some sectors, in your opinion, to watch for with a vaccine on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one is travel. And it's obvious, it's probably the one that's going to benefit the most, and has benefited the most. You know, mm. You've got to think. I think there's going to be 5 or 6 vaccines. That's my opinion. So I think you're going to have plenty of vaccines. I think you're going to have plenty of supply of vaccines. So I think we're turning the corner, and it's going to be an aggressive turn of the corner. You know, travel is the one you want to look to. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is airlines, but then there's corporate travel companies. I think there's going to be a lot of pent-up corporate travel. You know, airports are very good businesses, well, were very good businesses, you know, in terms of flights landing, they're going to see a tick up in revenue. Online travel companies, I think, will benefit well. Hotels, you know, Airbnb, we listed, that sector is going to do well. Another one you might want to look at is like mall operators. So, you know, us going back to the mall, going back to shopping, I know that we were moving away from it. There's going to be a lot of pent-up demand for that. And the other one that people might not think of immediately is higher education. So companies that are in higher education or universities.
Hmm.
It's very important to countries around the world to bring students back into universities because it develops a lot of tourism, develops a lot of economic growth. Australia is a key example of that. I think these companies will do really well from a vaccine. My point to investors is be careful. And a perfect example is something maybe like the cruise lines. You might think, you know, Carnival or some of these cruise liners might be a buy on the back of a vaccine, but these businesses are almost junk at this point in time. You know, they haven't done a long time. They borrowed a lot of money during this crisis at high rates.
Mm.
And whether they can sustain that with a vaccine is the problem. And the other one goes for airlines. A lot of these airlines should be defunct right now. And a lot of these airlines, you know, are defunct if it wasn't for cheap money in the market. So, you know, the investor might be inclined to go towards these type of businesses. But remember, these businesses have been shaken and have been hit hard. And the question is, can they maintain it even with a vaccine? And I think there's still a lot of questions on these type of businesses. But no doubt, the sector that benefits the most is travel. And you've got to think, I know you are, and I, we can't wait to jump on a plane or jump on a cruise line or go somewhere.
Mm.
Or stay in a hotel or go to the breakfast buffet. So these businesses, there's a lot of hype, but it's also kind of a double-edged sword for the investor, particularly how beaten up they are. And the only reason they've survived is on debt. Mm-hmm. And the debt has been funded, but it's been funded at quite high rates when you talk about how cheap money is. And whether they can sustain that debt is the key problem. And I think that's the biggest thing facing the market at the moment, is the amount of corporate debt that we've put on before the pandemic and during this pandemic. That's my thoughts on the vaccine.
That's really a nuanced look, because, you know, people have been talking about the rotation to cyclicals and looking at stocks thought to be most sensitive to vaccine news, like airlines, as you say, and aviation and, you know, those cruise liners. But like you say, you should be looking at the further potential for performance and weighing it against the debt that they've racked up. That's really terrific.
Yeah. And Michelle, if I can just talk to you about the rotation. I mean, that's sick of hearing about this rotation. We keep hearing about this great rotation. Mm. And the market's kind of rotated for a few days and still gone back to its area, which is tech.
Yes.
And there's a particular reason for this. You know, what investors must understand is it's because these are the companies of the future, and these are the most profitable companies, and the market still realizes that even with the vaccine, we're still going to be on Teams, we're still going to be using our Apple computers. So we keep talking about this sector rotation, and every time we see a pop in industrials or where the Dow outperforms the NASDAQ, we talk about this growth rotation, and then the market pulls back and goes back into tech. So, you know, it's been a fake out a few times. Some areas have done well, but we still haven't seen the sustained rotation out of tech. And I don't think we're going to see it before the end of the year.
Again, brilliant point. And I thought this, for the listener, Jack is not only a star here on Money and Me, he's also a star on YouTube, where he has his own channel. And speaking of computers and tech being the future, you have a really interesting video questioning whether algorithmic trading is running the stock market. And I wondered if you could give us the highlights of, you know, the answer to that question. And if so, what does that mean for the retail investor?
Well, Michelle, I've got to commend you. And a journalist that actually does some journalist work and research, well done. And thank you for the shameless plug of my YouTube channel. You can also catch me on Instagram. I'm very active at Jack Susie. But you bring up a really good point about algorithmic trading. So just to give some people some insight, I did a video on, you know, do robots control the market? And we talked about some statistics about, you know, 80% of trading, sometimes 90% of trading that's happening on a day-to-day basis is done by a software program or a robot. And that's quite true. It brings the broader question for me, for retail investors, is can you make money short-term trading? And the more I look into this, the more I think about it, it's getting harder and harder to do that for the retail investor, because you're just up against too much. You know, you're up against millions and millions of dollars, big money. You're up against artificial intelligence, robots pulling in data from all around the world and then trading the market with volume. And then, you know, this is why I say to retail investors, we often get, you know, mesmerized by the trade or the short term, or, you know, I can make 10% in an hour or a day. It's very difficult to trade the market. I've been in the markets for quite a long time, and it's getting more and more difficult because of these robots and artificial intelligence. So the point I'm trying to make here is don't try to trade it. You know, look for quality assets and buy and look at the long term. We often talk about long term and it's oversaid, but it's one of the greatest things, because that's when you can actually beat the robots. You're not going to beat them because they're trading in milliseconds. You're not going to be able to get the data they're getting. You're not going to be able to see what they're seeing in terms of icebergs and volume coming through. But when you can beat them is by being early to something, doing your research, and sitting there and being patient. And we've certainly seen that happen for years and years from retail investors. Finding good asset class, finding a good industry, buying in and being patient, and that's the best way to be an investor in the stock market. And that's the kind of point that I wanted to make out of it, is it's hard to beat, practically impossible. I don't even try to beat them, and I'm a fund manager, but we can beat it, and we can actually outperform them by looking at quality assets, holding for the long term, and being really patient with what we do.
I love it when we end on a positive note, Jack. That was terrific. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Michelle, for having me. And to Singapore, I love you. I can't wait to get back there. They're talking about a bubble between Sydney and Singapore. So if that's happening, Michelle, I'm coming live in studio. We can do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jack Cousy, founder and director of strategy at VFS Group. We're all thinking about, you know, what kind of food we're going to have to grill in anticipation of Jack's arrival. Soon, hopefully. I hope you've enjoyed Money and Me today. It's a terrific show. In case you missed the earlier bits of the show, you can listen to us on Spotify. You want to Google my name, Michelle Martin, and today's edition will come right up.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.